There's one moment where I don't know if it's supposed to be funny or not, but like they go into a murder scene and there's blood everywhere and it's very gruesome. And Forrest Whitaker's character says something like, "Something terrible happened here." And it's like, yeah, obviously. Like, is that your contribution to the investigation?
I was losing my mind over this character.
Hello and welcome to Camp Kaiju Monster Movie Podcast. We're your hosts, Matt Levine
and Vincent Hannum.
And we're talking about all our favorite monster movies, the good, the bad, and the downright campy, and asking if they stand the test of time.
Traditional kaiju, creature features, space invaders, the supernatural, and everything in between. All strange beasts welcome here.
Camp Kaiju is sponsored by Zach Linder and the Zach Pack, powered by Coldwell Banker Realty. Your source for real estate, home rehab, fixing and flipping for investor clients, and residential buyers. Reach out to the Zach Pack today for real estate services, follow the Zach Pack on social media, and contact the Zach Pack for investment opportunities. Links in the show notes.
In January, the message from an extraterrestrial source was picked up at the Parkes Observatory in Australia. A new sequence of DNA. Friendly instructions on how to combine it with ours.
This growth is amazing.
The decision was made to terminate the experiment.
Breaking out!
She escaped?
We have a serious emergency on our hands.
I want a team to track her. Hunt her down.
You created a monster. Now you want us to kill it.
We decided to make it female so that it would be more docile and controllable.
More docile and controllable. I guess you guys don't get out much.
She wants to have a baby.
She'll kill anyone that gets in her way.
I wouldn't hurt you.
Yes, you would. Just don't know it yet.
She'd have a dozen babies. She could lay 1,000 eggs.
Something's wrong.
Get
out!
Open the damn door!
Hey! Oh, God.
Vincent, it's good to see you. How you doing?
Oh, I'm good. I'm good. Last night was a really great time. You and I co-hosted the Film Friends movie trivia with friend of the pod, Naomi Osborne. This is her deal. We've been hyping it up on the podcast for months now. But last night was, you know, as of this recording anyways, we're recording on May 6th and trivia was May 5th. It was a blast. Met some really great people. Had some really great film-centered conversations.
Absolutely. I had so much fun last night. I have always loved trivia. Obviously, we love movies, but I've never co-hosted trivia myself. So I was honestly a little bit nervous when the night started, but it was so much fun. Great to meet people, like you said. Yeah, just really had a blast last night.
I'm glad you said that because I was also weirdly nervous. And here we are. I mean, we it's like a podcast, but people are actually watching.
Right.
Which is a different set of rules. But no, it went great. And I think my questions were a little hard. We had some kaiju limericks, listeners now. And, you know, maybe we'll share some of those at the break at some point in this episode. See if you can test your kaiju knowledge.
Yeah, that would be fun for sure. I didn't really do too many kaiju questions last night. I tried to sort of let you take the ball on that. But yeah, I love the limerick category. I was fond of my basketball-themed category since the NBA playoffs are going on now. So it was a great time. And anybody in the Twin Cities, if you are interested in going to Film Friends movie trivia, it's the first Monday of every month at Indeed Brewing. I think it starts at 7:30 every month. So check it out. Such a good time.
100%. Links to that and more in our show notes. And yeah, I'm ready to talk about species.
Yeah. I mean, we'll talk about our personal histories with this movie shortly, but all I really knew about Species was that it was trashy and sleazy, and it's about a killer alien. And I was like, well, we have to talk about this movie, right?
I think tawdry was the word you used last time.
Yeah. I love that word, and it certainly applies to the movie Species. Which, I mean, it's also kind of fun because it's 30 years old. It came out in 1995. And yeah. I just think that's kind of a cool era because, you know, I was 10 or 11 when this movie came out. I'm a little bit older than you, so you were probably like five or six, maybe, somewhere around there. But
it was four, but thank you.
Yeah. So it's kind of cool to like remember my childhood because I like knew about this movie when it came out, but I was too young to see it. My parents obviously would have never let me see this at the time. And it's just like a relic from another era, even though it's only 30 years old.
Well, speaking of relics, I do love this like period, the mid 90s for monster movies, mm-hmm. because The Relic was from around the same time. I mean, then you had like some pretty high profile movies, Independence Day, you know, Men in Black. But then you had some more kind of off kilter films like Species. The Faculty comes to mind.
Yeah.
That was from 99.
Mm-hmm.
But I think as we do this podcast and we watch all these movies, it's like kind of like a post Jurassic Park. Oh, we can blend the CGI with the practical effects from like our traditions. And I think the 90s was just like the great, almost like petri dish of artists saying, hey, let's do some messed up things with these new special effects.
Yeah. Yeah. It's I love the way that you put it, a petri dish of different styles and like experimenting with special effects. That's totally true. I feel like sometimes the final version of those experiments don't always age very well, but they're fascinating even for that reason, you know?
Yeah. Dr. Moreau, for instance.
Yeah, yep, there's some terrible CGI in that movie. And that will be a recurring theme throughout tonight's conversation as well, I would imagine.
Oh my gosh, yeah.
But not to get too far ahead of ourselves. Aside from Species, have you seen any other good monster movies recently?
Oh, since, you know, I watched Honey, I Blew Up the Kid. Oh, I watched The Shaggy Dog.
Ooh.
Which me and Patrick Kozicki are going to talk about when we do a crossover episode.
Cool.
Go check it out if you want to. It's like if Disney made a werewolf movie. Yeah, that about sums it up.
So very, I mean, I'm aware of The Shaggy Dog. I've never seen it, but very family friendly. Nothing remotely scary in that movie, right?
Right. But it's from 1959. So there's like some actual like Cold War commentary. There's spies involved. There's dark magic and lycanthropy.
Wow.
More than I bargained for. And I was, you know, I was there for it.
Cool. I might have to check that out now. I tend to lean into like the horror monster movies, but maybe I should like, you know, try to explore the comedic lighthearted side of that as well.
You know, one time years ago, you mentioned how much you enjoy Harry and the Hendersons.
Yeah. Very much so, yeah.
Yeah.
That movie's synonymous with my childhood. Watched so many times with my parents.
I've only seen it once, but, you know, this is my, you know, maybe you bring it to the podcast one day. Who knows?
Yeah. There are a lot of classic moments in that movie for sure. And like the famous bittersweet farewell between John Lithgow and Harry, which is like part of, I think, like pop culture. I feel like everybody just knows about that scene, even if they don't know what movie it's from. It's just like so well known and so frequently parodied and mocked. But it's a fun movie. So I'm glad you reminded me of that. Maybe that will be on the podcast someday.
Yeah.
I did want to shout out two monster movies that I've seen recently. One of which is a hugely popular movie right now. I feel like a lot of people are talking about it, but Sinners is as good as everybody is saying.
Oh, you did see it.
Yeah, yeah, nice. I did. And I don't think this is really a spoiler. I feel like probably everybody knows by now that it's a vampire movie. And I didn't totally love the specific vampire usage. Like, I kind of wish they had gone with a different monster of choice. But everything else about that movie I loved. And there's one scene right about in the middle of the movie that's like the best thing I've seen in a movie theater in years. And I could tell like everybody around me was like similarly just like jaw on the floor, losing their minds over it. It's really incredible. So definitely see that movie.
I can't. Oh, man. Don't overhype it for me. I'm going to hate you if I go in. I'm like, damn it. Matt overhyped it.
I'm sorry. That could be the case. I mean, the movie has some flaws for sure, but I didn't want to expect too much when I went into it, and I was really blown away. So I hope you are as well, Vincent, and everybody else listening.
Yeah, I will keep expectations low, so then I'll be I'll love it.
Yeah, I should keep my enthusiasm in check a little bit, maybe. The other one I saw, which is very weird and maybe not ultimately all that good, but definitely worth watching, is The Keep from 1983. It's an early Michael Mann movie. This is kind of a notorious production that was like taken away by the studio. And I think the initial cut of the movie was 210 minutes and the final version is 96 minutes. So just like so much was cut out of this movie. It's about an old kind of, they call it The Keep. I guess it's kind of like a fortress that's in Romania that a bunch of Nazis break into. This is set during World War II. They want to steal some treasure from this crypt thing, keep, fortress, whatever it is. And they unleash an ancient demon. So it's very much like Nazis getting like brutally annihilated. And
oh,
it's
my
very
gosh.
Yeah, and it looks gorgeous. It has a great Tangerine Dream soundtrack. So like really cool, trippy music.
Wow.
Ultimately, it's kind of a bad movie. Like it doesn't make any sense at all. But definitely worth watching, especially for Michael Mann fans or just horror movie fans. It's great in its own way.
That's fascinating. Wow. Yeah, very, see?
Yeah.
Got to put that on my list now.
Totally. Yeah, I've been wanting to see it for years. There's a good new Blu-ray copy that just came out of it. So, yeah, check it out for anybody.
Will do.
Yeah. Well, getting into our nuts and bolts of Camp Kaiju before we dive into our episode tonight, thank you all for hanging out. Please rate Camp Kaiju and review wherever you listen. You can also send us listener comments at campkaiju@gmail.com or our Instagram page at camp_kaiju. If you'd like to be a featured voice on the show, leave a voicemail at 612-470-2612 telling us about your favorite monster movies and memories. Please check out our website, campkaijupodcast.com, for more reviews and special content. And finally, you can check out our merch at campkaiju.threadless.com. Become a patron at patreon.com/campkaiju for discounts, priority comments, and access to any live events. We thank you so much to our patrons. We really appreciate you. Yeah, I mean, hopefully more swag, more opportunities for meet and greets and stuff like that coming up. So thank you to our current patrons, Jason, Chris, Sean, Peggy, and our anonymous patron.
Yeah, definitely have some plans kicking around in my head. Matt, we can talk offline maybe about some viewings or some screenings.
Yeah.
Some other kind of live events that we don't have to like break our backs over, but still deliver some quality experiences around monster movies.
Totally. I love that. Whatever form it takes, I'm very excited for it. Just hanging out, watching movies and talking about movies. That's what we're about here.
Heck yeah.
Cool. And up next on Camp Kaiju, Vincent, there's a movie that you're bringing to the pod. Do you want to briefly mention what's going to be next?
Yeah, next we are going to visit some traditional kaiju with Gamera, the Giant Monster. As it's known in the American release, Gamera the Invincible. There are some differences in the cuts. I'm going to do my best to watch the Japanese subtitled version, Gamera Giant Monster. But for the listeners out there, no harm, no foul if you catch Gamera the Invincible. I think that would be an interesting conversation, the compare and contrast. But it's the first Gamera film ever made. From Daiei Studios. So I think it'll be really great to visit an original big kaiju such as Gamera.
Getting back to the classics. Yeah, I'm excited for sure. And I just watched the Japanese version, I think like 2 or 3 years ago. So maybe I'll try to watch the American cut this time around.
Okay. Yeah, that one's public domain. You'll find it on Tubi anywhere.
Cool.
I think I have some bargain bin DVDs with it. So, it's all right. The quality may not be good, but the movie's the movie.
Right, yeah. It'll be a cool compare and contrast, though, if we watch the different versions. So, I'm excited. Gamera, friend of all children.
You know it. And then after that, we are watching your pick. Is it Swamp Thing?
I think you might be right. I haven't looked that far ahead in a while.
Swamp Thing, a friend of all children?
who knows? I mean, I've never seen Swamp Thing. I'm excited to watch it. You're right that Swamp Thing is my next choice. And like the 80s version directed by Wes Craven is the one that we'll be talking about. Yeah, I hope that Swamp Thing is a friend to all children. I feel like he is. He's very eco-minded, you know, eco-friendly.
Okay. Well, so is the creature from the Black Lagoon, but I wouldn't call him child-friendly.
Yeah, true. But I'm, you know, I mean, you fell in love with the creature from the Black Lagoon when you were a child, so maybe he is a friend to all children, you know?
I mean, how do you define friend, really? That's what we're getting into.
Yeah, yeah. A common theme from monster movies.
He's just misunderstood.
Right, yeah. He's your friend if you treat him well. If not, then look out, you know?
Very excited to watch a Wes Craven movie that's not A Nightmare on Elm Street. I haven't done that personally, so yeah, I'm looking forward to that episode too.
Me too, yeah, for sure. So some good stuff coming up on Camp Kaiju. Stay tuned.
Mm-hmm.
As far as species goes, what is your personal history with this movie?
It's so funny when you suggested this movie for the podcast, because I think I facepalmed because I watched like 2 years ago. No, yeah, it was last year when I was on parental leave. I was staying up late with Ada on just like sleeping in my lap, just a newborn baby. And I did something that I don't really do. I just like blindly watch whatever movie looks interesting. Mm-hmm. And I was on Hulu. And I went through a string. I watched like Live, Die, Repeat or Edge of Tomorrow. I watched some other tawdry films. Basket Case, I think, was one of them.
Oh, yeah. That's very tawdry.
Chud, very tawdry. But then I saw Species and I was like, well, that looks like an alien movie. Let's watch it. And, you know, after I was done, I was like, well, that was 2 hours of my life that I don't think I would have spent if I had nothing else to do. But
yeah.
With that said, there's a whole lot of camp in this movie. Not always intentional. Actually, I don't think any of it's intentional.
Yeah, there's a little bit of intentional humor in the movie, but most of it probably is unintentional.
Yeah, and I'm not going to bury the lead too much, but I have a lot of critiques with this movie. I'm going to pull my hair out a little bit as we talk about this movie, but I think therein lies the fun of talking about this movie. So, you know. I love all monster movies, even if they make me crazy.
Yeah. Yeah. And this one can definitely make you crazy for sure. There's, well, yeah, not burying the lead, like you said, but like some stuff to love or like, at least some stuff to be really entertained by, but a lot of stuff that just really goes off the rails and is kind of cringeworthy. So we'll talk about that shortly here.
Yeah. Okay. Well, what's your personal history?
Up until last night when I finally watched it, I didn't really have any history with this movie. I, you know, kind of like I briefly alluded to before, I was 11, I think about 11 years old when this movie came out. And I remember even back then, like the marketing tactic for this movie was like naked women all the time, you know, like that's what they really promoted. And the movie did really well for that reason, which I don't know if that's a good or a bad thing, but I was aware of it at that time. I was 11 years old, like I said, and I was like, ooh, I would like to see this movie, but that's not going to happen anytime soon. So it is fun to return to it, you know, like 30 years later. I'm obviously very different than I was when I was 11 years old. And, you know, I mean, like the tawdry, sensationalistic elements, they're there, absolutely. There are a lot of them, but there's a lot of other stuff too. A lot of other stuff to talk about. So, but it was no. It's like a yeah. I remember very distinctly being a young kid and hearing about this movie and yeah, everything it had to offer. But
no, that's cool. I wish I could remember some of these movies from back in the day. You know, I saw Titanic in the theater of all things,
mm-hmm.
and I was about 5 years old. So it's possible my mom took me to see Species. But it's not possible because she's not that kind of mom. But
yeah, covered your eyes for most of the movie. Or
most of the movie.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Have you seen any of the sequels?
No. Have you?
Me either. No, I have not. And like, even though, you know, I have mixed feelings about this one, I am kind of like morbidly curious about the sequels. So maybe I'll check them out.
I just want to know if the rat alien hybrid appears in the sequel, because if it's not about that rat, why am I watching this sequel?
Yeah, that is a campy ending for sure. And like, what a good idea for a sequel, you know, like a rat alien sexy woman hybrid. I would definitely watch that movie, but I don't think that's what they did, sadly.
Careful, you'll convince me that I like this movie.
That's one of my main missions tonight. Not really, I'm just kidding. But I wouldn't be sad if that happens.
From the producer of Aliens and Terminator 2.
33% Homo sapien.
Part human?
What are you talking about?
Gradual extinction of the human race.
The Relic. Rated R. Starts Friday, January 10th.
Can we see you for a minute?
These students are starting to suspect their teachers are from another planet. Guess what?
Now we're gonna have some fun.
They're right. Now, these six students won't just question authority. They'll have to destroy it.
No way!
The faculty.
Please report to the principal's office.
Rated R. In theaters everywhere, Friday, December 25th. It fills the darkness. It feeds on fear.
What the hell is that?
It has come to destroy the only threat to its existence. The virus.
Oh my God.
Called man. From the producer of T2 and Aliens. Virus, rated R. Starts Friday, January 15th at theaters everywhere.
On Dr. Moreau's island, there are three rules. Don't drink the water. Don't disturb the natives. And whatever you do, don't feed the animals. New Line Cinema presents the science fiction event of the summer. Marlon Brando, Val Kilmer, David Thewlis. The Island of Dr. Moreau, directed by John Frankenheimer, rated PG-13. Now playing.
So let's dive into the crew of the movie Species. A surprisingly, like, very accomplished, capable crew, I would say.
100%, yeah.
Yeah. So it's directed by Roger Donaldson, an Australian filmmaker. He's worked in Hollywood, in his home country of Australia, New Zealand, the United Kingdom. I feel like he's one of those directors where, like, you've probably seen a movie by him, even if you're not aware of it. He made Dante's Peak. He made 13 Days. No Way Out, the Gene Hackman, Kevin Costner movie. So he has some, like, fun, maybe not great, but still entertaining, you know, just like good stories in his resume.
Yeah, I see he directed Cocktail,
yep.
Which for a time was one of my favorite movies. But I digress. I don't want to talk about Cocktail with the time we have.
Fair enough. I've never actually seen Cocktail. I know that's supposed to be a pretty bad movie, but Tom Cruise's star power made it a huge hit.
Yep. I went through a Tom Cruise phase. He could have done anything, and I was there for it.
Yeah, totally. And I think that's true of a lot of people in the late 80s, because I think that's why that movie was a huge success. Maybe, you know, not the best movie on Roger Donaldson's filmography, but I feel like he had a skill for, like, making okay movies that made a ton of money, and the studios loved him for that, you know?
Well, yeah, certainly you're going to get work with that. But listeners, let us know, Cocktail or Species, which do you prefer? That's the question for today.
Two very different movies. Wow. I mean, I assume, since I haven't seen Cocktail, but
we're talking too much about Cocktail.
Yeah. Sorry. One more thing about Roger Donaldson. He also made a remake of Mutiny on the Bounty, which we were talking about last night.
Oh, who was in that? That was Mel Gibson.
Yes, exactly. Mel Gibson in The Bounty from 1984, another Roger Donaldson movie. Yep.
Yeah. Yep.
Which I haven't seen. I'm not really dying to go through Roger Donaldson's oeuvre, but, you know, maybe I'll check it out at some point.
Well, nice use of the word oeuvre.
Love that word. I feel like you have to pronounce, like, really pronounce it, you know, as French as possible whenever you say it.
Why would you not?
Yeah. Oeuvre. It was written by Dennis Feldman. He's another guy who, well, maybe he doesn't have a lot of hits on his resume. He did write The Golden Child, the Eddie Murphy, another movie I've never seen, but the Eddie Murphy, like, comedy, supernatural sort of fantasy movie from the 80s, another Dennis Feldman joint in addition to Species.
Hmm.
And then he wrote the first four Species movies. And also, this is one of the things I love about Camp Kaiju. I discover or like rediscover so many movies where I'm like, oh yeah, I do want to see that at some point. So Dennis Feldman also wrote the movie Virus from 1999, starring Jamie Lee Curtis, another killer alien movie, which now I'm like, oh yeah, I'm dying to see that. I got to check it out.
See, it was a thing in the 90s. Aliens and sci-fi was a big genre in the 90s.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I think like you were talking about before, maybe it's just the appeal of special effects, and that's like the best way to get that special effects work out there, you know?
Yeah. Okay.
Do you want to talk about any of the other crew members?
Sure. Cinematography is by Matt. Help me out here.
I gave you the hardest name. Sorry. Andre Bartkowiak, I think is how you pronounce his name.
Okay. Andre Bartkowiak, a Polish director of photography. He worked often with Sidney Lumet. Lumet?
I've heard Lumet, but I guess I don't totally know which one is accurate.
Okay. Well,
sorry. I'm fairly sure it's Lumet, but I could be wrong.
Well, okay, that's fine. Well, either way, Sidney Lumet, you know, films Twins, Falling Down, Speed, Jade, The Devil's Advocate. And so he collaborated with cinematographer Andre Bartkowiak, who later became a director himself, primarily of action movies like Romeo Must Die, Exit Wounds, and Cradle to the Grave.
Romeo Must Die is a fun movie. I don't know if you've seen that.
No, I'm not familiar.
It's good. Jet Li.
All right. Oh, okay. Well, Species is edited by Conrad Buff, an Oscar winner for editing Titanic. That's the second time we've mentioned that tonight.
Yeah.
Also edited Equinox. Oh, my God. Yeah. Equinox, Matt, you got to see. It's an essential viewing, independent, like student film, but features some really great stop motion demons and like a Necronomicon type of book.
Whoa.
It's fascinating. I own it. Criterion Collection. Check it out.
Awesome. Yeah. That's yet another one where I was like, I forgot about this movie and now I need to see it as soon as possible.
It's the producer is the same producer of The Blob. So Equinox gets kicked around in conversations with The Blob a lot.
Cool.
Blob a lot.
Yeah, the remake of The Blob, I assume, right?
No, the 50s one.
Wow, yeah. Cool.
Yep.
Nice.
What else? Battlestar Galactica, Empire Strikes Back, E.T., Raiders of the Lost Ark, Poltergeist. So he worked with Spielberg a lot, James Cameron, Roger Donaldson, Antoine Fuqua, and M. Night Shyamalan.
Big name.
Yeah.
And that's
the thing about Species. There's so many big names working on this picture. So, you know, more to come on that. Music by Christopher Young, who worked on horror movies and thrillers such as Hellraiser, The Grudge, Drag Me to Hell, Sinister, Nightmare on Elm Street 2, Invaders from Mars, Tobe Hooper's 1986 remake.
Which, of course, was not that movie, but the original Invaders from Mars on our last episode.
Yeah, this is great. We're going through like a whole lot of just classic horror sci-fi movies.
Yeah.
But here is the creme de la creme. The special effects dude, H.R. Giger. Do you want to talk about Mr. Giger?
Yeah, sure. He, of course, is most famous for designing the aliens from the Alien series, the xenomorphs, who are now part of horror movie lore based on H.R. Giger's designs. He's done a lot of art over the years, a lot of like sketches, paintings, puppets, even aside from his film work. Not surprisingly, very dark, kind of like biomechanical, like humans mixed with monsters, mixed with machines. Mm. So yeah, he designed the look of Syl in this movie. Syl is the name of the alien played in human form by Natasha Henstridge. However, Giger's design of Syl went through a lot of transformations throughout the production of this movie. He had a lot of different ideas for like different stages of her evolution, and ultimately the movie really only makes use of like the final design that he created. So there is some H.R. Giger in this movie, not as much as there could have been, unfortunately. Giger did also design the nightmare train sequence, which initially was like 20 minutes long. It was like really intense and surreal when H.R. Giger did that. And in the finished movie, it's like less than a minute long. So that's definitely a bummer.
Yeah, I'm not even sure I know what you're talking about. But she's on the train.
Right, but it's before then. It's when Syl is still played by Michelle Williams as a girl at the beginning of the movie.
Yeah.
And she has all these intense nightmares. And in one of them, she like sees herself as an alien in like full tentacled alien form.
Yeah.
And she, like, yeah, there's like this nightmarish train. It's like an eerie light blue color. And like, yes, everything in the background is like all dark and black.
I remember now. Yep. Yeah. And it like turns into an alien and eats her, scoops her up.
Yes, I believe so. It's hard to tell what's happening though.
Yeah. Unfortunately, a lot of those dream flashes, I find like I can't really see what's going on and not in a good way. Like, it's okay to like, oh, what's going on? You know, add some mystery to it. But I felt like it was just messy. It was just sloppy and I wanted to see the design of the alien. That's the thing.
Yeah, exactly. I totally agree. And H.R. Giger agreed as well. He was very unhappy that they, you know, they took that scene and they cut it down. And like some of the other dream sequences too, we never really see the alien clearly. And he was very upset about that.
Yeah. Okay.
Not surprisingly.
No. So more about H.R. Giger and his work coming up soon, I'm sure.
Yeah, definitely. So H.R. Giger's designs then were kind of built as practical models by Steve Johnson. He owned, I think the company was called XFX, if I remember right. He had his own special effects company. I had never really heard the name Steve Johnson before, which I feel like is an oversight on my part because he grew up loving Universal Monster movies and Hammer horror films. So he's like, you know, he's like us, basically. I mean, that's, you know, that's our background as well. Steve Johnson met Rick Baker in high school. Rick Baker helped Johnson get a job with Rob Bottin, who worked on The Howling, An American Werewolf in London, Poltergeist 2, Big Trouble in Little China, The Abyss, just all of these huge special effects movies that I had no idea he was a part of.
I love that, too. I love learning about, because like I'd always known about Rick Baker, but I love learning about the other giants of the industry, Geiger, Bottin, and Steve Johnson, apparently.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a name I didn't really know before, but I feel like he, you know, maybe he's not at that, like, you know, godfather of special effects sort of level, but I feel like he's a name that should be better known.
For sure. All right. Steve Johnson, we hereby lift you up.
Camp Kaiju seal of approval.
Yeah.
So, yeah, a very, very accomplished crew on this movie. And the cast, surprisingly, pretty accomplished as well in its own way. Maybe we'll start, though, with the person who was not so established when she appeared in Species, although she certainly appears a lot in every possible way in the movie. Natasha Henstridge, this was her debut role. She was 21 when she made the movie. She had a long career in modeling, maybe not so long, but she had a career in modeling before this. She doesn't really have like an extensive list of credits throughout her career, but she was in Maximum Risk, the Jean-Claude Van Damme movie, which is fantastic. I love that movie. And she's great.
You love Jean-Claude Van Damme.
I do. After Jackie Chan, he's my favorite action star, for sure.
That's awesome. I another blind spot of mine is martial arts films. So that's good to hear, though.
Yeah, I grew up with those movies, and Maximum Risk is maybe JCVD's best movie, and she, Natasha Henstridge, is very good in it.
You know, I do not mind her performance in Species, actually.
Yeah.
I think, here's something. I watched an interview with her on YouTube from the 90s. She was promoting the movie. And, you know, I got done with the interview. It's like 5 minutes. She was fine. She was very charming and gracious. But I made note, this critic in me, I critiqued the interviewer because 4 out of 5 questions was about the nudity.
Yeah.
Or about like her hair color or about anything other than her actual work on the film.
Yeah.
And it's just like a double standard, right? Like Ben Kingsley would get questions about like, so take me through your process. I'm sure he would. Any of the male actors would.
Right.
And she's like, she gets questions. She gets bozo questions about her looks. I'm like, well, I'd, you know, maybe it was just a 90s thing. It was a 90s thing. It's not a now thing. But right. I'd like us to remember that, you know, beautiful women are also talented professionals who would probably like to talk more about than their bodies.
Absolutely. Yeah. And she must have gotten that all the time when this movie came out. I mean, again, that was kind of like what this movie was known for when it was released. And I'm, you know, I've watched some interviews with her as well and like read some interviews. And like you said, she's always very gracious and always very like, oh, it's a fun movie. She has like nice things to say about it. But I don't know. I can imagine some of that stuff must have been pretty obnoxious for her.
Absolutely. Yeah. So Natasha Henstridge.
Yeah.
We lift you up. Camp Kaiju stamp of approval.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
You don't
yeah.
need our approval.
No, indeed. But you have it anyway.
Yeah, there you go.
And then just the rest of this cast is like insane. I don't know how all these people were thrown into this movie together.
Stacked. Yeah.
Yeah, stacked for sure. Do you? I feel like you're a fan of this next guy. Do you want to talk about him at all?
Well, I do like Ben Kingsley. I have not seen as much of his filmography as I'd like to. In Species, he plays the shady government officer, Xavier Fitch. He's like the ringleader. He pulls all these this ensemble together. He's the head of the scientific team that is experimenting on Syl, who's like a weird daughter figure to him.
Mm-hmm.
And anyways, Ben Kingsley, I know him mostly from his Shakespearean background with the Royal Shakespeare Company. He's a contemporary of Ian McKellen and Patrick Stewart and many more. Did he win an Oscar for Gandhi?
I think so.
Yeah, I think so too. He played Gandhi. He was in Schindler's List. Movies like Sexy Beast and Species. Saying those movies in the same sentence is almost unfair.
Right.
Sure, he has a lot of range. However, he's not infallible, and I have some critiques for Mr. Kingsley at the end of this episode.
Well, for this role in particular?
For this role.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Certainly fair. Yeah. I'm excited to hear those critiques. I feel like I'll have the same ones. I'm curious, have you seen Sexy Beast?
No.
He's amazing in that movie. Like, that might be my favorite Ben Kingsley performance. He plays like a really intense, over-the-top gangster, and he's so charismatic, and he talks a mile a minute, and like, he's so fun in that movie. It's really good.
Oh, well, good.
Yeah.
I hope he's having fun.
Yeah. A lot of range for that guy. Maybe not so much range in this particular role, but yeah, we'll talk about that later.
Well, how about Michael Madsen? You talk to me about him because this is the Allstate guy, right? The Mayhem?
No, they have a similar look, but the Allstate guy, I can't remember that actor's name, but he was on 30 Rock and some other and TV shows. But
wow, I watched the whole movie thinking this was the Mayhem guy.
Similar types, but Michael Madsen is probably best known for starring in a lot of Quentin Tarantino movies. He was in Reservoir Dogs, Pulp Fiction, both of the Kill Bill movies, The Hateful Eight, and he's been in some other stuff too, The Getaway, which is another Roger Donaldson movie from the 90s, Wyatt Earp, Donnie Brasco. He's, you know, he takes a lot of bad roles, or roles in bad movies, I should say, and he's always pretty honest about it. He's like, yeah, some of these movies are terrible. Like, I gotta put food on the table. I'm trying to, like, you know, provide for my kids or whatever. So I kind of like when actors are candid about that. He was pretty excited to be in this movie because he plays a pretty heroic role, although he's like a government mercenary slash assassin. I don't know how heroic he actually is, but and he was proud of this movie. He has said in interviews he really likes it a lot. But personally, I'm like, oh, I might include this in some of your not-so-good movies, Michael, but he's an interesting guy.
Cool. I have a lot to say about him later on, too. But I respect the game. You know, you gotta make money. So
yeah,
there you go.
Samuel L. Jackson does the same thing. He's talked about how when early in his career, when he was a struggling actor, he didn't get roles for a long time. So now he's like, or for a while anyway, he was like, anything I am offered, I will take, because I remember what that was like to not get any acting offers.
Yeah. And it's hard out there, even for established actors. You know, it's still freelance work. You don't know if your next job is going to come along.
Yeah, exactly. So I kind of admire that a little bit.
Yeah. Yeah.
How do you feel? So I don't know if anybody's looking, you know, I don't think anybody can see the background behind Vincent right now, but this next actor is hovering over you right now digitally.
Alfred Molina, baby. I love this guy. I first encountered him. He played Doc Ock in Spider-Man 2, Sam Raimi's film. Fantastic in that role, but also just a fantastic actor. He has a very small part, memorable part in Raiders of the Lost Ark. He's in movies like Prick Up Your Ears, Maverick, Dead Man, Boogie Nights. I really enjoy him in.
Mm-hmm.
And I enjoy him in this movie too. another critique. I'm just going to pepper in my critiques. Otherwise, our wrap-up will be too long at the end. Yeah. His character doesn't do anything in this movie. I don't know if you noticed, but he's always just there. He never adds anything, except he's a crucial plot point at the end where he impregnates Syl. Yeah. That's the only reason his character's in this movie.
Right.
Regardless, I love Alfred Molina.
Yeah, he's a fun presence in this movie. He's supposed to play an anthropologist, but yeah, like you said, he doesn't provide anything beneficial to their, like, you know, search for Syl. He doesn't really do anything at all, but still a fun guy. Still, like, a fun character, and especially, like, the friendship that develops between him and Forrest Whitaker's characters is kind of fun towards the end, but I feel like that's mostly because of what the actors bring to it and not because of the writing.
100%. You can't beat their chemistry. Try as the writing may.
Yeah, right.
Forrest Whitaker, you want to talk about him?
Yeah, I mean, you know, he's become a legendary actor, I think. He's been in movies for the past 30 or 40 years. You know, Fast Times at Ridgemont High, Vision Quest, Color of Money, Platoon, The Crying Game, Body Snatchers, which I really want to see, the third version of Invasion of the Body Snatchers. Mm. Never seen it, really want to see that. Probably my favorite Forrest Whitaker performance is in Ghost Dog, The Way of the Samurai, the Jim Jarmusch movie, which is very, very good. He's in Panic Room, Last King of Scotland, just like an amazing filmography. His character in this movie is so weak. He's supposed to be like an empath who apparently has like telepathic capabilities. And it's like, how did he get those abilities? Where did this guy come from? How was he found by the Ben Kingsley character? What is he doing here, you know?
Matt, if I had to pick one thing that drives me loony in this movie, is his character. Because you're right. And I looked into it. I was like, clickety-clack, can empaths also be psychics? There is some, like, not paranormal, but pseudoscience out there around that possibility. But the way his character is treated in this movie is like a sideshow psychic. Just like, so what's going to happen? And he's like, I don't know. And I'm thinking, then why the heck is this written into the script? It's not funny.
Right.
I was losing my mind over this character.
Yeah, totally agree. There's one moment where I don't know if it's supposed to be funny or not, but like they go into a murder scene and there's blood everywhere and it's very gruesome. And Forrest Whitaker's character says something like, something terrible happened here. And it's like, yeah, obviously. Like, is that your contribution to the investigation?
And it's delivered completely serious. Right? Like, it's not tongue-in-cheek, and that's, A, why this movie is so campy, but also why it's so terribly written.
Yeah, it's a mess, yeah. And I feel like, you know, Forrest Whitaker does deserve some credit because his character is tolerable in this movie. Like, I feel like if anybody else played this role, he would be insufferable, and I just might not have been able to make it through the movie, but he makes the character, like, you know, I'll watch this character just to see what happens, but I don't buy anything that's going on right now.
Wow. Yeah. I've got some more moments I'll share later, but he just deserves so much better.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, he's had better throughout his career. Like, I feel like this might be one of his lowest points, but that's why this cast is just so bizarre. Like, how did all these great actors sign on to this movie? It's strange.
Yeah. Yeah.
Rounding out the cast, we have a few more cast members here. Marg Helgenberger, who's probably best known from CSI. That's how I mostly knew her before.
Oh, sure.
She stars as biologist Lauren Baker, who has sort of fling with the Michael Madsen character in this movie. And then the last cast member that I wanted to talk about is an actor that I really like a lot, really respect, admire very much. She's been in so many great movies. Michelle Williams. This was one of her first roles. I think she was 14 years old when they filmed this movie.
Yeah, I really enjoyed seeing Michelle Williams in this. I love her work whenever I see her. I think she just like disappears into roles. I feel like she's not talked about in the same breath as think of like any superstar female actors. Mm-hmm. But yet she is 100% committed. I think she's really good at her craft. And even in this movie, I think she does a really good job with what she's given.
Absolutely. She, like, the first 20 minutes of this movie are the best part, and they're all the scenes with her when, like, we're just kind of, you know, we jump into the action. Michelle Williams is, like, the young Syl, and she's in this government facility, and then she escapes, and there's this, like, hunt after her. It's really compelling, and then as soon as she leaves the movie, it gets like immediately worse. I'm not necessarily saying that like it's because she's not in it anymore, but she is very good here. I think she's really engaging in her role.
Completely agree.
So shout out also to Michelle Williams.
Stamp of approval.
Yeah. We're just handing out stamps of approval to everybody tonight.
Well, not everybody.
Yeah, good point. So again, just like a very accomplished cast and crew. The film itself, maybe not so accomplished, but we'll talk about that soon.
Yeah. Reminder, everybody. I love talking about this movie. I just feel bad being so harsh on a movie, but, you know.
Yeah.
I got to call it as I see it.
I feel like you are like very generous and lenient on movies, so it's kind of fun to hear you be a little bit more harsh. And weirdly enough,
it often.
No, it does not. It's kind of refreshing in a way.
Oh, good.
And I feel like we're in a little bit of a role reversal because there are actually some things I like about this movie. So we'll talk about that later.
Fantastic.
Yeah. But first, just a very brief production rundown of this movie. It's, not really all that complicated. I'm thinking of our conversation about The Island of Dr. Moreau, which took like an hour just to like talk about the production backstory. So like this one is not as chaotic as that, but the writer Dennis Feldman first pitched the movie as a treatment or just kind of an in-depth outline in 1987 when he was working on his directorial debut called Real Men, which is also about an alien invasion. Don't really know a lot about that movie. Not at the top of my list, but maybe I'll watch it someday. And in those early stages, when Feldman first created that treatment, it was a little bit more of like a police procedural. It was basically about geneticists and a biologist teamed up to create this alien creature, and then they have to work with the police to find it once it escapes. So obviously the project went through a lot of changes over the years as it was in development.
When no studios bought the pitch, Feldman rewrote it as a spec script. It caught the eye of producer Mancuso, who liked the blend of believability and preposterousness. Sure, I can see that.
Yeah.
And MGM ultimately bought the script. It was then that director Donaldson became involved, wanting to do a sci-fi thriller. The script was rewritten 8 times over a period of 8 months, correcting some of the plot holes. Yeah, Matt, as you note here, but not all of them.
Yeah, definitely.
You corrected any plot holes?
Right. What did the script look like before that,
Oh my gosh. All right, the film was filmed mostly in Los Angeles with some scenes shot in Utah and at the Arecibo Observatory in Puerto Rico. I think better used in GoldenEye.
Yes, for sure.
And most of the $35 million budget went to the special effects, as this wasn't a, quote, star-driven picture. Hence the casting of newcomer Henstridge, and I think what we alluded to earlier, the relative supporting, the ensemble's made up of, I wouldn't call A-listers at the time.
Yeah.
More of a supporting roster there. But H.R. Giger designed the Syl character. He was intrigued by the idea of designing a monster that was also seductive and attractive. He worked on the film from his native Switzerland, building puppets and faxing designs to Los Angeles. Giger initially wanted to design several stages of Syl's transformation, but ultimately only her final form was used. And Giger also thought there were too many similarities between species and popular franchises like The Terminator and Alien, which, as we know, Giger also played an important role in. Giger ultimately convinced the producers to rewrite the ending. The initial cut was 127 minutes long. It had a very different action climax, and 20 minutes were cut out of the final version.
Which is crazy because that climax feels like it goes on forever. Like it still feels very overlong.
It's a long one.
Yeah.
The finished film combines practical models based on Giger's designs and created by Steve Johnson, with CGI overseen by Richard Edlund and his Boss Film Studios. Edlund had started out with Industrial Light and Magic. Star Wars was one of his first projects. In 1983, he created Boss Films, which did the effects for Ghostbusters, Big Trouble in Little China, Die Hard, Cliffhanger, and the greatest movie of all time featuring an airplane, Air Force One. Boss Films was one of the first special effects houses to make the transition to CGI. And Species includes some of the very first CGI that involved motion capture, which makes me think about The Mummy from 99, because we talked about motion capture in that movie too.
Yeah.
And how it was still in its infancy in 99. Meanwhile, 95, when they're producing Species, yeah, that technology is so nascent.
Yeah.
It's just so, so early in its effectiveness, I think.
Yeah, it's definitely rough in this movie. And I feel like maybe, you know, Species kind of gets like credit for being one of the first to use motion capture. And it's a historical turning point, I guess, in that way. But it looks terrible. And like, you know, it's just like put somebody in an alien suit. It would just look so much better than like the I mean, even at the time, I can't imagine that like the CGI in this movie looked very good or convincing. Like, it's... Yeah, I don't know. Maybe it's just interesting from a historical timeline, but it looks pretty bad in Species.
Well, let me clarify. So when I think of this movie's poor use of CGI, I think of the ending when we see the full-bodied alien creature.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay. There is CGI, like in the Michelle Williams parts where she's transforming, that I don't think is as bad.
It's not as bad. I remember thinking, like, in the scene where she's in the train car and she's first turning into the alien, you know, I don't think it looks very good, but I was like, oh, this is, like, amusing from, like, a mid-90s CGI, like, it looks so different kind of way, you know?
Agreed.
I was still on board at that point, but it's, like, by the end, it's just like, oh, my God, this is, like, unconvincing, not scary, not original, not interesting. Like, I was not even enjoying it anymore by the end.
Also agree.
Yeah. Sorry to Richard Enlund. I think that was his name, right? Not to hate on his work too much. Influential, perhaps, but in this early iteration, does not hold up very well.
Well, you got to start somewhere, I suppose.
Yeah, indeed. So Species was released in July 1995. It was one of the big kind of summer event movies of that year. It made $17 million in its opening weekend alone. That was MGM's biggest opening at the time. And it was second that weekend after Apollo 13. So, again, this movie did really well financially. It had a $35 million budget. And overseas, I think it made, like, or like, you know, cumulatively, I think it made something like $130 million or something like that. So just a huge success for MGM.
Wow.
Yeah. Critically, maybe not so successful, though. It definitely got mixed reviews. A lot of pans, a lot of negative reviews in there as well. Kind of like I alluded to before, you know, the marketers really did try to play up how much sex and nudity was in the movie. It was discussed in a lot of entertainment magazines. I had a subscription to Entertainment Weekly when I was a kid, and that's probably how I knew about that. Tabloid magazines were kind of making a big deal out of that as well. So that's, you know, all that stuff is probably part of the reason that this movie did so well.
It spawned a franchise. There was one theatrical sequel and two made-for-TV sequels. Love that. The film, or rather the franchise, was also adapted into a comic book series published by Dark Horse Comics. And I could see it totally working as a comic book or these, you know, made-for-TV sequels.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think maybe that's kind of the realm this kind of tawdry movie should inhabit.
Yeah, it really belongs there.
And that's not a diss. If this was like a Sci-Fi Channel original movie, amazing, wonderful.
Right. Yeah. I mean, you know, that's why I'm curious to watch the sequels. Like, I feel like if it fully leans into its ridiculousness and it's just like sleazy, sensationalistic aspects, which Species kind of does, but like at the same time, it just kind of gets boring by the end. And like, we'll talk more about the flaws in a little bit here, but I don't know. I bet some of the sequels could just be like good, campy fun. I'm excited to try them out.
I do too. Like, don't try to shoot for the stars, make this big A-level movie. Mm-hmm. Just stick to your lane and then it's hypocrisy maybe to say it, but like your whatever flaws you have, I think just play better on TV and in that kind of market. I don't know.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
There it
maybe
is.
Maybe some sequels will appear on Camp Kaiju in the future. Who knows? Probably not for a while though. We need a break from Species after this.
I have a long list. Species 2 is way down at the bottom.
Yeah, for sure. There are approximately 2,000 monster movies that I want to watch before that.
Yeah, that's the number I was thinking of, yeah.
Yeah. Well, now is probably a good time for our sponsor break. Once again, Camp Kaiju is sponsored by Zach Linder and the Zach Pack, powered by Coldwell Banker Realty, your source for real estate, home rehab, fixing and flipping for investor clients, and residential buyers. Reach out to the Zach Pack today for real estate services, follow the Zach Pack on social media, and contact the Zach Pack for investment opportunities. Links in the show notes. Vincent, do we have anything in Menia's mailbox today?
We have a lot. I might even read two comments tonight.
Ooh.
We got a lot of feedback on our Island of Dr. Moreau episode.
Cool.
On our YouTube. Love the YouTube crowd. They're always chiming in. So this is from at Bingo Bet It All Beaver. I also love these handles. Yeah. Bingo Bet It All Beaver says to the Island of Dr. Moreau, if this movie was a mess, it still wasn't as big a disaster as Alien 3.
Hmm. Interesting. Yeah, I suppose that's probably true. There's some stuff about Alien 3 I like, but yeah, good point.
Yeah, I think of all, I think any of the, I'd love to talk about any of the Alien movies, but Alien 3 always stuck out to me as something that's like, there's a lot going for it. There's a lot working against it. I'd like to talk about that one at some point.
Definitely. And just such a turning point in David Fincher's career, because he had such a miserable time making that movie and had so much studio interference.
Yep.
And then his career kind of took off afterwards. So that would be a fascinating conversation someday.
Yeah. Well, thank you, Bingo Bet It All Beaver. We're going to read a comment from your YouTube compatriot, Brandon Harries. Brandon Harries, they say, Leonardo DiCaprio has bought the film rights to this film, Island of Dr. Moreau. They're doing a remake of this and Anthony Hopkins is in it.
Hmm.
They actually then clarified the remake is called Eyes in the Trees. And if you Google that, that is a movie that came out or it's in pre-production.
Interesting. And
Eyes
in the Trees.
Yeah.
Does it star Leo and Anthony Hopkins? They're both in it.
So the Wikipedia page for Eyes in the Trees says it is an upcoming science fiction film starring Anthony Hopkins. Mm-hmm. It is a reimagining of H.G. Wells' novel, The Island of Dr. Moreau. Okay, so looking at some... Okay, Deadline Hollywood had a piece on it from August of last year, 2024. Kind of just saying the same thing.
Hmm.
So this movie is an idea that's out there. I hope it makes it to the screen. Because who doesn't want to live in a world with more Dr. Moreau?
Yeah. Wow. I'm very intrigued. I don't know this director's name, Timothy Woodward Jr., but regardless, I'm excited about this movie. I hope it is actually made at some point.
Same. So thank you to our listeners everywhere. We have more comments to read in future episodes, and it's a good problem to have. So keep your comments coming. You can comment on Spotify, you can comment on YouTube, our Instagram, and please call in the Kaiju Hotline and tell us about, well, anything really, but right now we're specifically looking for your experiences with Jaws or the franchise, how Jaws has changed you for the better or the worse. Just share with us, give us a call, the number is in our show notes, and we'd love to do like a special Jaws 50th anniversary episode some point in the summer.
I can't wait. I'm excited to hear about everybody who is no longer able to swim in the ocean because of that movie or that franchise.
Yeah. I mean, me, I'm one of those people, and I did not see this in 1975.
Right. Yeah. I mean, every time I go in the water, like even like a deep swimming pool, I just think I'm going to go underwater and like the Jaws theme is playing in my head and like a shark is just going to come out of nowhere, you know? That's an impact. That's a cultural impact right there.
Yeah. So let's hear all the voicemails. I think it'd be a really cool episode. So hoping y'all come through for us.
Awesome. I can't wait for that.
Yeah. Well, we are going to turn it over to Peter Laurie. He's somewhere trimming his lilacs. He's dealing with some kind of crazy thing. I haven't talked to him in a while, but he is going to talk about the 1942 Poverty Row movie called Black Dragons.
Whoa.
It's a World War II horror film starring Bela Lugosi, It involves mad scientists, Japanese scientists, Nazi scientists. I don't know anything about it, but I'm going to learn something. And I always learn something on the Poverty Row Picture Show.
Yeah, Peter's very knowledgeable about film history. I always learn a lot from him.
He was there.
Yeah, yeah. True. First-hand knowledge. Yep. I hope he's doing all right. Is it trimming his lilacs? Is that a euphemism for something? It sounds kind of dirty.
No, he has a lilac bush.
Okay. It's
growing to monstrous proportions. Get your head out of the gutter. What are you talking about?
It just sounded like it. Maybe I've been... I watched Species 2 recently. That's probably why. My mind's still in the gutter.
No, I mean... I know what I said.
Yeah. I'm going to have to research that phrase now. It has a hidden meaning of some kind.
You're just going to find a picture of Peter Lorre.
That'd be okay. I would not be disappointed in that at all.
Okay, before we conjure up any other dubious images.
Yeah.
Welcome to the Poverty Row Studios on the other side of Hollywood, where the stars were dimmer and the red carpets dripped with blood. Together we will watch the best of the worst, movies known for their limited budgets, outlandish concepts, and questionable performances. But with enough haunted houses, zombies, ape men, and devil bats to keep you up at night, this is the Poverty Row Picture Show, and I dare you to sleep through these nightmares. I am your host, Peter Lorre. You may remember me from such motion pictures as the Mr. Moto series I did for 20th Century Fox. Yes, in 8 pictures, I played the hard-boiled Japanese secret agent, Mr. Moto. And if you are thinking to yourself, but wait... Peter Lorre is not Japanese. Then you are correct. It was a different time when cowardly Hollywood executives would not cast Asians as such heroic characters. And this prejudice would be cemented with the outbreak of war between the Empire of Japan and the United States in 1941. Another consequence of the war, understandably, was the proliferation of propaganda in Hollywood pictures. This week's movie, Black Dragons, is perhaps the first major movie to capitalize on the rah-rah wartime spirit. It is about the real-life, notorious society known as the Black Dragons of Japan, a ruthless criminal organization, as they concoct a devilish scheme with the Nazis. The Black Dragons instruct a brilliant scientist, Dr. Melcher, played by Bela Lugosi, to travel to Japan on a secret mission. There, he operates on 6 Japanese conspirators, transforming them to resemble 6 American leaders. The actual Americans are then murdered and replaced with their likenesses. Treachery and espionage ensue. Now, this film was rushed into production only a month after Pearl Harbor, and the finished product does reflect this hurried schedule. Dear listeners, I do not exaggerate when I tell you how poorly executed this movie is. Lack of budget can hardly be blamed for the sloppiness on screen. Plot points are contradictory, actors are lifeless, and the camera work doesn't do anything to heighten the would-be tension or clear up any confusion. But you know what? This movie literally ends with a big ol' American flag waving triumphantly over the nefarious Japanese agents. It is a heck of an exclamation point and somehow the most memorable part of a film with so much potential. To watch Black Dragons, you will either be a diehard horror fan or die trying to make sense of it all. Oh, hello, my lovely giant lilac. Is it feeding time already? Well, dear listeners, if you'll excuse me, I must take care of my plant. It is growing remarkably well here in the apartment. No, Matthew doesn't need to know. I have everything entirely under my control. Until next time, when we will be watching yet another Bela Lugosi picture called The Corpse Vanishes.
To Jurassic Park.
We've made living biological attractions so astounding that they'll capture the imagination of the entire planet.
The most phenomenal discovery of our time.
How'd you do this?
Becomes the greatest adventure of all time.
Can I touch it?
Sure.
Universal Pictures presents.
You feel that?
Hold on to your butts.
A Steven Spielberg film.
Fences are failing all over the park.
Yeah, that's nice. Gotta go.
An adventure.
Look out! Go!
I can't get Jurassic Park back online.
65 million years in the making. Jurassic Park.
In 1995, mankind's first experiment with alien DNA was a mistake.
She's a genetic duplicate of the original Sill.
In 1998, man's first trip to Mars will be a disaster.
There's something wrong with me, Dad.
We've got two aliens running around.
I told them not to go to Mars!
It's mating season again. Species 2, rated R.
So what are the themes or the subtexts in this movie? Do you want to start off, or are there any themes that you want to talk about?
Yeah, just like I think the main theme for me is procreation. I mean, the Sill character, her whole mission is to have a baby. And I think that is a very universal theme, that can be such a human, primitive animal instinct. Right? The survival of the species. Well, there it is. There's the title of the film.
Oh, I get it.
Yeah, I think that's a theme worth looking into. You know, mm-hmm. what length does she go to? Pretty extraordinary lengths, violent lengths, murderous lengths. You know, not how I would go about having a baby, but you could sympathize with that at any rate.
Yeah, definitely. There's a lot to say about that, I think. It's weird because, like, there is some empathy for Sill, I think, in this movie. Like, she essentially is a girl. She has, like, the brain of a girl. Like, you know, she ages very rapidly. So when she's played by Michelle Williams, supposedly as, like, a 12-year-old, they say in the movie, this is only, like, I think a couple days after she was born. Like, she ages so rapidly. So she still has the mind state of a girl and is, like, imitating human behavior. Her, like, you know, it's in her species, her DNA to, like, procreate, as you said. So I think there's some empathy for her character in this movie because she's confused. She doesn't know who or what she is. And she's only doing, like, what she thinks she's supposed to do. And then at the same time, you also have this depiction of, like, you know, a beautiful woman who is treacherous and deadly. And, like, the pregnancy itself is monstrous. Like, you know, as soon as she's impregnated, she's like, oh, I just felt the conception happen. And Alfred Molina is like, oh, no, you silly girl. It doesn't work that way. And then he, like, touches her belly and he's like, oh, my God, this is the alien. Like, this is actually happening or whatever. And that's just such an overdone theme, I think, in horror and sci-fi movies where, like, you know, a beautiful, frequently naked woman is like a source of monstrosity and evil and violence and terror and all that. So it's, you know, it's not unique to this movie, but there are just so many movies that have seemingly should have empathy for their female characters, but then turn them into this, like, monstrous thing where you, like, should not trust a beautiful woman. And that's obviously not a great theme, you know?
Right, right. I mean, and it's not like it's a femme fatale film noir. She's depicted as a monster. Also depicted, there was... I don't use the word rape lightly, but that is definitely a tactic she's headed towards with that blonde hunky man she has in the swimming pool, the jacuzzi.
Yeah. Yep.
You know, she is forcing herself on him very much against his will, which actually I appreciated. Maybe appreciate's not the best word, but I noticed a role reversal in what we'd usually expect, maybe a subversion of our expectations, where the man is saying, I don't want this. And it's the woman who is forcing herself upon him. I just think usually we see it the other way around. And I found it interesting that it's depicted in this way.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. And like earlier in the movie, I think we do see the inverse of that, which is a little bit more common, where like she's in a hotel room with a guy. And then like the logic in the movie, I'm using the word logic very loosely, is that this guy that she's about to sleep with, she can like sense that he's diabetic and therefore has like imperfect genes or whatever. So she's like, oh, I don't want to do this anymore. I'm leaving. And he's like, no, you can't. It's too late. Like I'm not going to say take no for an answer. And then she brutally kills him. So we, you know, there's that scene earlier in the movie, but then you're totally right that later on those roles are totally swapped. And it's just a question throughout this entire movie. Like, how does it feel about the Syl character and how's the audience supposed to feel about her?
Right. And I think, you know, I'm coming around to some good things about this movie. I think Natasha Henstridge, like whatever the marketing was about her body, I think she might be the best written character. Mm-hmm. I think she certainly has the most range with her character as written, because she's able to play both victim and the, what, I don't know, what's the word I'm looking for? The victim and perpetrator. Like she can play all those in this movie, which is that's a plum role for many women to be able to play that kind of dynamic character, who's also sexy, which can be a good thing. And, you know, she is a model. She's very comfortable in her body. Mm-hmm. So I don't want to dilute that aspect of empowerment. You know, I think Natasha Henstridge is great in this movie, the more I think about it.
Yeah. She has an amazing presence. Like, I think maybe her performance itself doesn't have a lot of obvious range, but like, she's the kind of actor, I think, in this role where, you know, she just has this like presence and this like gravity to her, you know, and like you can't take your eyes off of her whenever she's on screen. And I don't mean that in like a lewd sort of like, you know, she's so nice to look at way. She like genuinely has like a lot of like star power, I think.
Agreed. Yeah. I think the bar is low.
Yeah.
But I think she does a damn fine job in this movie, in all things considered.
Yeah, definitely. That was the main theme that I picked up on, too. I actually thought about Jurassic Park a little bit, and I am not comparing those two movies at all by any means, but, like, you know, Jurassic Park also has the theme of, like, life will find a way, and, like, that's what animals do, procreate. Like, that's kind of, like, built into our DNA or whatever.
Yeah.
This movie is, like, a very sleazy reiteration of that theme, I think.
Totally genetics gone awry type of thing. I thought about The Fly a lot. I mean, it's a common theme in these types of science fiction movies.
For sure. Yeah.
This is a silly theme, but it kept coming up. There are like at least three separate times in this movie where people make a big deal about a credit card.
Yeah.
you know what I'm talking about?
Yeah, absolutely. That's kind of how they track her down, because she uses a credit card that she stole.
Yeah, but like, There's a cashier at the train station. She's like, do you have a credit card? And then there's the motel clerk. He's like, ma'am, you forgot your credit card.
Yeah.
It got to the point where I wrote down, is there a thing about credit cards I'm missing?
I guess I'm a little bit confused, or just not very like well informed about the history of credit cards. Were they just becoming a thing in the 90s? They must have been around for a while.
Absolutely not.
Yeah.
You know, you see 80s movies, people are using, charging their cards and things. It's a whole thing in Home Alone.
Yeah,
on the card.
Yeah, you're right. That's weird. And I feel like in this movie, it's the thing too, where like they use paper to like take an imprint of the credit card and like get the numbers and all that. And it's just kind of cool to see those old technologies, I think, you know?
That is cool. Yeah. So weird thing, credit cards in this movie, but maybe it's like numbers and sequences.
Yeah. It's all about capitalism. Not really. I'm just kidding.
We could tie most things back to capitalism, but yeah. I don't know. That's just like a fun, that's a silly comment, but it's something I noticed anyways.
Yeah, you're right. I didn't really like make note of that aside from like the cool part where like they take the paper imprint of the credit card or whatever, but you're right. That is kind of strange.
Yeah.
And I, you know, I do kind of like the idea that like, you know, alien contact might not happen from like an alien coming to Earth in a spaceship. It might happen through like information that's sent through like radio signals, and that, you know, that's in the movie Contact, that's in some other movies as well. But, you know, I think like the origin of the Syl character is kind of interesting in this movie because the aliens send to Earth the genetic code for like a human alien hybrid, and that's how Syl is born. And I just think that's maybe a little bit more, I don't want to say interesting, but it's just nice to have that variety instead of just like actual Martian invaders that come in a spaceship, you know.
For sure. I do think that about this movie. I think that it's an alien movie, yes, but not on the surface.
Right.
Yeah.
The movie starts off that way and then it abandons that idea pretty quickly, but it's there at first.
Oh, I the first time I watched this, I did think, "Oh, this could be a really interesting procedural." It does play like that at certain points. But it doesn't really, I think, take full advantage of that genre. You know, this could be like Seven with an alien.
Whoa.
And it's just not nowhere near what it could be.
Yeah, it's strange that that was like the initial idea. And then they like, you know, came up with this idea instead to like, you know, I read that Dennis Feldman thought that it was like unconvincing and there were too many plot holes in that police procedural idea. And it's like, well, this is not any more believable.
Make them work. Work with a team and write a better draft.
Yeah, I feel like that could have worked way better than like the story they came up with here, but what do I know?
It was like the Avengers. Like they assembled this team of you know, disparate powers. And I'm like, which is kind of, you know, there's nothing wrong with that. That's cool. Mm-hmm. But nobody uses anything to any advantage.
Yeah.
Alfred Molina doesn't do anything with anthropology. Our empath character is just like a convenient way to plug those plot holes.
Yep.
The blonde woman, I apologize, I forget her name. She says one thing in one scene about the genetics of the thing. Michael Madsen is, I'm sorry, I think he's just phoning it in completely. Just playing like this cool guy with a gun. I'm like, that's not a character. I don't know what you're doing. And then Ben Kingsley has no business even being a part of this crew. Because he's the head of this big, you know, agency. Why is he running around in the sewers? He should just be calling in the army.
Right.
Everything is so contrived in this movie.
Totally. Are there no military doctors that are like more accomplished, you know, biologists and anthropologists than these people that they bring in? It makes no sense. And like the way that plot development is introduced, like there's like a very brief scene introducing us to Michael Madsen. And then like another like 30-second scene where Forrest Whitaker is in a like a therapy session, and all of a sudden they're all in this like government office. And it's like, what is going on here? It makes no sense. I know I've said that a lot already, but
they're like, I'm going off right now. You got me rolling. But they try to have like these witty one-liners, this banter, and I'm like, you're all really bad at this. Like there's no chemistry apart from the script being poorly written.
Yeah.
But it's like, what is supposed to be funny? It's not funny. And like, I could see when the film wants me to laugh. And I'm like, I'm not laughing at that joke. That was a really bad joke. But I'm laughing at everything else you guys are doing because it's, you're just taking it all so seriously, but it's so heavy handed. And it's just so contrived. And I, even in my monster movies, I don't like shortcuts. Like,
yeah.
Play it straight. Even in the most bonkers monster movie, justify your actions. Just cut out the filler. And there's so much filler in this movie. Okay, I'm done for now.
I know what you mean. Like, I, you know, sometimes if people complain about plot holes, I don't have a, like, I usually don't feel the same way because I'm like, it's entertainment. It can be implausible. Like, I'm kind of okay with that sometimes. But to your point, I feel like there has to be like an internal logic to the movie, you know? Even if it's making up its own rules, it has to abide by those rules. And this movie does not have any kind of logic whatsoever. And like, the plot holes seem like way more than just like fun little like ridiculous things. It's like the entire thing is flimsy. It falls apart if you think about it for like more than 2 seconds, you know?
Thank you for being so articulate with that, because it's a hard thing to describe. There's every movie has an aspect of what's called suspension of disbelief. Mm-hmm. I know you know that, but for everyone else. But there's but again, you're playing by your own internal rules that sells that suspension of disbelief. I buy that Jurassic Park can happen.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
I don't buy anything in Species. And what that difference is, it's hard to pin down, but you know it when you see it.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. And I think we're working a little bit of our like final breakdowns into this conversation, but that's totally okay. That's all right. You know, I think that's why I like the first 20 minutes of this movie, because it's like a government guy, Ben Kingsley, who is kind of, like you said, he has this like sort of pseudo father-daughter relationship with Syl when she's still a young girl, and then she breaks out and there's this like really exciting, intense chase to find her. I was like, oh, I'm fully on board. Like, there are some cool special effects. I'm into this story. But then, yeah, like once they bring in other characters, once Michelle Williams becomes like the adult Natasha Henstridge character, it's like, oh, it took a wrong turn. And like, I feel like it could have sustained that element of just like fast pace, you know, like very cool, like shocking, visceral images. It could have kept on going with that, but it just really falls apart pretty quickly.
Yeah, loses steam.
Yeah.
In a big way.
Totally.
All right, sorry. Get us back focused. I'll focus up here.
Well, I mean, I think we've kind of reached almost the end of the line. I was trying to think of a Species pun there, but I couldn't do it.
The train pun.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, there is some train stuff. So yeah, I think it's time for our individual breakdowns, the good, the bad, and the campy. We've already mentioned a lot of things in those categories, but I feel like I liked this movie slightly more than you did, so maybe I'll turn it over to you first for the good category. Is there anything else that you want to mention?
I do like the effects of this movie. They are very visceral, brutal, violent, like the practical effects, not the CG stuff. Mm. The alien design, the practical design, is really interesting. And bonkers. At one point, tentacles come out of the alien's nipples.
Yeah.
And like strangle people. I'm like, what is this? It's amazing.
Yeah.
Need more of that. I didn't get enough. Yeah. Natasha Henstridge takes the cake for me.
Yeah.
And all in all, that's about it for me. Sorry to say.
That's fair. Yeah. I agree with all that. I do think it's a very entertaining movie. Up until like the last 15 minutes, I think the climax in the sewers just like goes on and is like the least interesting way they could have ended the movie. But up until then, I was like, oh, this is really fun. Like, there's a lot of bad stuff, but I'm like very entertained by this movie. Like, there are some scenes where like my jaw was just hanging open, and that's for a lot of reasons, like how ridiculous it was, but also just some of the special effects shots, like you said. Weird cutaways, or like cutaways, not the right word. Weird, like edits to a new scene where it's like, whoa, where are we right now? Maybe not a good thing, but like it does keep the movie like very unpredictable and entertaining for a while. And then, you know, I just want to shout out the cast one more time. It's such a bizarre cast in this movie. I agree with you that Natasha Henstridge is the best part. And, you know, like obviously she's beautiful. And like, I do think like it's the appeal of like larger than life movie stars that are like gods or goddesses. Like, I kind of like that element of cinema, and that goes all the way back to the silent era. And there's a little bit of that in this movie, and I kind of enjoy that about it for a while. And then it gets a little bit like creepy and vulgar towards the end. But, you know, I like all that stuff. Alfred Molina, Forrest Whitaker, their characters are terrible, but the actors themselves are fun to watch. Michelle Williams, you know, I really like her a lot. And like, it's cool to see her in such an early role where I think she still has that, like, you know, again, that star power. I'm going to use that term again. But like, you know, even if she was a newcomer, you're like, oh, she just has like an energy and like sort of like a compelling aspect to her. So, but mostly it's just the entertainment value. This is a very fun movie for like 80% of its running time, I would say.
You're not wrong. I do appreciate the over the topness of this film, the preposterousness.
Yeah.
And yeah, I need to be reminded of that. So thank you. Thank you.
I've always believed that like movies can have a lot of flaws, but they cannot be boring. That's the one like impermissible sin, you know?
Oh, you know what? I was never bored by this movie. I may have been driven absolutely out of my mind.
Yeah.
But that's not boring.
Yeah. Indeed. Yeah. Hopefully it's more than that. But you know, I do think if it's entertaining, I want to give it a little bit of the benefit of the doubt, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
But yeah, there's so much bad stuff about this movie. Maybe, you know, we can kind of flip the script. I'll maybe say one thing, but then I'll allow you to go off if that sounds
good. Okay.
I don't even know where to begin, though. Like the CGI, I'm sorry to hate on CGI so much on this podcast. I know I do it a lot, but it just like immediately takes me out of the movie. And it's like, just put somebody in an alien suit. You have H.R. Giger designing these suits and Steve Johnson, like, you know, working with him on that. Like, that could have been really amazing. And then you just have the worst CGI, like, imaginable. It looks terrible. So that's a big negative for me. And I'll just kind of, you know, the theme of like, you know, don't trust a beautiful woman, she's just gonna kill you. Like, you know, the tagline of the movie is she mates, she kills. And I feel like that's like this movie's worldview in a nutshell. Mm. So it's hard to like really love a movie too much if it has that kind of subtext to it, you know, not to read too much into it, but yeah.
Oh yeah. I right. I mean, that's the studio, that's the marketing. I think it speaks to this shallowness that we see in a lot of 90s movies and media in particular around women and females and the male gaze. Mm-hmm. I'm not saying it's changed much, but it is a quite dated aspect of this film. When you go back and watch some of the interviews and you're like, oh, really? That's what you're going with?
Right. It's sometimes I'm okay with like sleazy and trashy, but it's like it has to be the right kind of sleaze, and it gets a little bit off-putting or disturbing maybe at times in this movie. Towards the end especially, I think.
Yeah. I've already gone off. I just want to talk about Ben Kingsley and his accent. He tries to do an American accent. I'm like, this is a bad accent. He's hitting his R's really hard.
Yeah.
Which I know is like what the Brits do when they like got to do an American accent. But I'm like, you don't sound natural. You sound like you're doing an accent.
Yeah.
And he has some terrible lines that honestly, I can't find it. I'm not going to waste time finding it. But there was a line he said that he just mumbled because his accent was so thick and so bad. I was like, that was unintelligible. I don't know what you just said.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, man. I know he has so many bad lines of dialogue in this movie. And now, of course, I can't really think of any of them.
Well, there's like, he's like, we made her female so we could, you know, control her mind or whatever. Or so she'd be more docile.
Yeah.
And then Michael Madsen, he's like, well, then you don't know much about women.
Yeah.
I'm like, that's a line where I'm like, the movie wants me to laugh. I'm not going to give it that.
Right.
That's a, that's such a dumb line.
It's so predictable. Yeah.
Predictable. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, and all the stuff where he's kind of like making fun of the scientists a little bit. Like, I think actually when Forrest Whitaker says that thing of like something terrible happened here at the murder scene, Ben Kingsley says some like stupid reply where he's like, oh, is that what you have to offer? Or something like that. And it's like, well, why did you enlist him on your team then? Man, it's so, no, yeah, just no internal logic whatsoever.
Well, by the end, he treats Forrest Whitaker as a full-blown psychic because they're in the sewers and he's like, which way did she go? Which way did she go? And Whitaker's like panicking. He's like, I don't know. I don't know. Yeah. And Ben Kingsley's like, then why do we have you here? And I'm like, that's the very question I've been wondering this whole runtime. Why yeah. do you have him here?
Why don't you answer that question, Xavier Fitch? I feel like you made this decision. There is a great moment in that same scene where, like, you know, Forrest Whitaker doesn't know which way she went. So Ben Kingsley's like, all right, well, follow me, Dan, or whatever his name is. And Forrest Whitaker is like, no, nah, I'm just going to go with these guys. I'm going to go up here. That's a very awkward moment, but I loved it.
It's a weird, awkward moment. That's a good way to put it.
Yeah. And there's just so much camp value like that in this movie. you know, the supposed rapport between Michael Madsen and Mark Helgenberger, you have before, but it's like,
God,
it's painful. Yeah. Like,
so painful. Like, yeah, their lines are just, okay, we get it. You're going to hook up. Can you just do it now? Like, what is this foreplay?
Yeah, it goes on and on. And the actors, I think they kind of do what they can. You're right that Michael Madsen is phoning it in and doing like a Robert Mitchum, like falling asleep in front of the camera sort of impression. But there are some elements of that I liked, but the screenwriting itself is very, very, very bad.
Yeah, it's unfortunate.
One more campy thing that I wanted to bring up. We can go back and forth if you want, but in addition to this team of scientists, there are also these two government agents that are just like hovering around everybody the whole time. They're like wearing business suits and like clearly they're government agents. And like even when they're in like nightclubs and like, you know, supposed to be like blending in, there are these two guys that are just like always in the background of the scene. And I don't know if that's supposed to be funny, but I laughed like almost every time I saw them.
Because why aren't they on the team?
Yeah.
I watched a review. It was like, you know, this team after Syl, like a superpowered malicious being, you don't send scientists and an empath in there. Like they yeah. all need to be trained assassins like Michael Madsen.
Yeah, totally.
Like why is Alfred Molina following this monster around?
Yeah. Yeah, right. And like they all seem to be very bad at their jobs. Like if there was any like believability in this movie, all of them would have been killed by Scylla within like half an hour, I think.
Oh my, totally. Yeah.
Ridiculous.
The one campy thing I want to share, this was not supposed to be funny, but it had me laughing out loud. When Michael Madsen and
the woman that kind of has a flirtatious thing with him.
Yeah.
Marg Helgenberger is the actor.
Marg Helgenberger. They are locked in like the lab to do like a genetic test. And then things go haywire. And the sample of the alien starts to mutate and like increase in size very quickly. And behind the glass, you have Ben Kingsley and everybody. And Ben Kingsley's like, oh no, it's all gone wrong. We gotta lock the doors and we can't let our friends out. But everyone is screaming, open the doors for like 5 minutes
yeah.
while this mutation is happening. And I'm cracking up because I'm thinking, dude, just open the door. You could do it. Just open the door. Ben Kingsley's like, I can't open the door. I can't do it. Don't make me. It goes on for too long. And you realize you could just open the door.
Yeah.
And I think that's what ends up happening.
Yep.
After like 5 minutes of mayhem, you're just like, oh my, okay.
Yeah.
What was that? Why are we yelling at each other?
Right. Yeah. I think like he does like incinerate that like creature or whatever. And then he opens the door, but it's like, yeah, you didn't need to do all this. You know, you could have just let them out and then reclosed the door. Shouldn't be that hard. Yeah, that scene is pretty amusing. I was kind of still on board with the movie at that time, and I was like, this is really stupid, but it's still kind of entertaining, and like, you know, you get like a big blob alien creature. I was like, okay, that's fun.
I agree, yeah.
But a very ridiculous scene, for
so,
sure.
So over the top.
Yeah. And then I won't ruin like the quip at the end of the movie when Michael Madsen, you know, maybe it's not a spoiler, I don't know. I'll just say there's a quip at the end. It involves, you know, vulgar language, so I'm not going to say it here. But it's so stupid. It's like the worst quip they possibly could have done. You know, I have a weakness for just like bad quips in action movies, but this one is like embarrassing, I would say.
Yep, yep. They were trying to go for something iconic. It's like you can't try for iconic status.
Yeah.
It just has to be organic and, you know, easier said than done. But
yeah, yeah, totally. What they come up with here is not cutting it. I'll just say that. All right. Anything else in the good, the bad, or the campy that you want to bring up?
Nah, I'm good.
Okay. All right. Well, we've arrived at the time of Camp Kaiju, the end of every episode, where we give the film a rating. As always, our highest rating is it's a timeless classic. It definitely stands the test of time. Our second rating is there may be some antiquated moments, but overall it's great. It stands the test of time. Our third rating is it may be historically significant or just fun, but it does not stand the test of time. And finally, our lowest rating, it is not worth revisiting. It definitely does not stand the test of time.
Okay. I'll go first because I think you're going to end on a positive note, which is always nice.
Okay, cool.
I have seen this movie twice. It lost a lot of its sheen upon second viewing, which means it went from the second to last to the last category for me. Wow. It's been a while since I have judged a movie like that. I think the idea of this movie is a lot of fun. I think there are some really strong moments, but overall, I don't need to watch this movie again. I guess watch it with a group of friends. I mean, we're laughing, we're having a good time.
Yeah.
Right? So it has value. But I have to say, I don't think it stands the test of time on its own. And there are other movies of this ilk from the 90s that I would much rather watch.
Definitely agree with that. Yeah. I feel like you can objectively state with a lot of evidence, like it is not worth revisiting because you revisited it and it was, you know, it did not hold up. So I feel like you can, you have proof that it deserves that lowest rating, perhaps. That's all totally fair. I've only seen it the one time, so I do think I'm going to give it our second lowest rating. I do think it's very fun a lot of the time, not all the time. Love some of the creature effects. I do like Natasha Henstridge a lot. I think, she's just, is a lot of fun to watch. I do have a weakness for kind of, trashy exploitation horror movies, but there's some bad stuff that goes along with that, too, of course. So, yeah, some stuff that I really like about this movie that I think is a lot of fun, but it does not stand the test of time in many ways. Already I can see that even after one viewing. So, yeah, not as just, fun and, trashy as I was hoping it would be, with a lot more flaws than I expected. But maybe still worth one viewing, I would say.
Yeah, see it once. I think you're right on the money with that, Matt. Yeah, thank you for bringing it to the podcast, though. Thank you for making me watch it a second time.
I'm glad I had an excuse to finally watch it. I've been wanting to for the last 30 years.
Yeah, I love that.
And maybe I'll watch some of the sequels soon and let you know how terrible they are.
Please do.
Yeah.
You let me know. I'll trust you with that.
Cool. Yeah, I'll make the sacrifice. Well, again, next time on Camp Kaiju, we're going to be talking about Gamera the Invincible, or Gamera Guardian of the Universe. Is that what it's called?
No, the giant monster.
Oh, okay. Gotcha. From 1966?
65.
Somewhere around there.
Yep.
Cool. Very excited for that. Stay tuned for that episode, everybody listening right now. Thank you so much for hanging out, friends. Please rate and review wherever you listen. You can also share this podcast with a friend. Subscribe to the website and send us listener comments at campkaiju@gmail.com or on Instagram. Links are in the show notes. If you would like to be a featured voice on the show, leave a voicemail at 612-470-2612 telling us about your favorite monster movies and memories.
And just a reminder, call in about Jaws. Let us know, please. We look forward to hearing your voice on the show.
Please check out our website, campkaijupodcast.com, for more information. Camp Kaiju is recorded in Minneapolis, St. Paul, with Minya's Mailbox Music by Ben Cook Feltz. Thanks, friends, and until next time, stay campy. Camp Kaiju is sponsored by Zach Linder and the Zach Pack, powered by Coldwell Banker Realty, your source for real estate, home rehab, fixing and flipping for investor clients, and residential buyers. Reach out to the Zach Pack today for real estate services, follow the Zach Pack on social media, and contact the Zach Pack for investment opportunities. Links in the show notes.
Look!
Come on! Get us out of here!
Open the goddamn door!
I can't let you out till I
open the door now!
You gotta let him out.
I can't do that! Open up the fucking door!
Let us out!
Somebody's gonna stop drawing, Ben. Let him out! Open up the door!
Chris!
What the fuck is that? Come on, get to the other door! Let her out, bitch!
Can't let her out, Chris.
Ah!
I can't do that!
You motherfucker!
What's wrong with you? Let her out!
You've gotta let them out, bitch!
Get out of here!
Get out of the way!
Get out of the way! What is this thing? What is
it? Get destroyed in 2 minutes. I'll have to burn the whole room.
What?
I have to burn the whole room. You got less than 2 minutes to kill or burn.
Disconnect the gas line in the isolation box. Use it as a flamethrower.
Laura, stop moving. I think I killed it. It's dead! Open the door!
It's dead, Fitch. Let them out.
Oh, God. It's not dead.
Not dead.
Oh. Shit.
What are we gonna do?
30 seconds remaining.
There's not much time. We gotta get out of here.
Well, he's dead enough. You gotta let him out.
You can't do that. It might escape. I have to follow protocol.
What protocol?
Protocols by which we're running these experiments.
15, will you tell him that if all that went in there?
13. Bitch. 12.
Let them out.
11. 10.
Bitch. Let them 9, out.
I have to follow protocol.
Let them out, 7, bitch.
6,
go, go, go.
3, 2, 1.
I hope you realize I had no choice.
Yeah, sure.
With the protocol to burn the room in 2 minutes if anything went wrong.